Hello, and welcome to Shed Talks. I'm Jeremy Thomas. I give talks on good mental health. I write books. I spent an eon of time in the music business, and now I'm here. Shed Talks is going to be a series of conversations with interesting people. People drawn from the world of books, music, film, telly, gardening, sport, prisons, business, all sorts of things. And they're going to talk about many things. They're going to talk about their mental health, other people's mental health. And they're going to talk about life jackets, what keeps them afloat. And I hope you're going to enjoy it. I think it's going to be great. Don't rush off at the end of the chat, because we've got our own very, very special psychologist, Karen Callan, who's going to spend the last few minutes talking about the programme and talking about what's gone on, a little bit of insight for us and what you can do to get over some of the problems aired. So don't run away. It's all going to be very groovy. And yes, you don't have to be 18 or over to listen to this, but it just might help. Stay tuned. Today, we are seriously lucky to have the wonderful Tim Clark, co-founder of IE Music, the company that's guided the stellar career of Robbie Williams and many other successful artists over the last 23 years, former managing director of Island Records and all-round top geezer, ambassador UNICEF, awarded the OBE in 2008, has been made a tribal paramount chief in Liberia in 2016. Tim is one of the very, very, very good guys of the music business. Tim, great to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. I'm not sure I deserve it, but thank you.
You grew up in Kenya, a little bit outside Nairobi, I think. And I remember when we talked before, we almost sort of glossed over this, that you said that your father died when you were either 10 or 11. In my experience, that's a pretty serious thing to happen. What about you? What happened with you there?
Clearly, it was a huge loss. Actually, I grew up in a very remote part of northeast Uganda called Karamoja, and my parents were missionaries. And we lived a pretty lonely life, it has to be said. But I went to school in Kenya. I went to school, first of all, in a little town called Kitale. And then after that, I went to school at the Prince of Wales in Nairobi. So I did spend a lot of time in Kenya because of schooling. But my home life was actually in Uganda. So my father died. He died of cancer, which we think he probably got from asbestos when he was pulling apart a little house. But I remember very clearly I was staying with my brother and sister at a farm owned by friends of ours. And my mother came back from Nairobi, where my father had been in hospital. And she just simply said, children, the Lord Jesus has taken Daddy. So that was how I learnt of it. And actually, I remember bursting into tears, and then I ran off into the bush. But I crept back a little later and hid in the guest bedroom under the bed. Meanwhile, of course, my mother and her friends were scouring with all sorts of farmhands, were scouring the farm, which was a pretty big one, for signs of me. I guess that was just a whole thing of trying to attract attention, trying to say, look at me, my life's over.
Yeah, but I mean, that's pretty understandable.
at that age. I mean, I would just ask you one question about that, in the sense that I always think that being brought up in Africa is quite different to being brought up in the UK, as an example. But I don't know whether that background helps you be more open in terms of grief, or whether it's shut up and get on with it.
That's an interesting question, and it's probably a mixture of both. Certainly, we were always pretty close to death. They had hearses, which were really bicycles, and they would strap the body onto the onto the carrier over the back mudguard, wrapped in elephant grass. So I was very familiar with death, and I think it said that Victorians were very familiar with death. Well, I guess that was true of us.
Yes, and I think it's probably a good thing, as opposed to the opposite. Where I spend a lot of time in Greece on an island, anybody who dies is buried within 24 hours. And they're, you know, the day they're being buried, they're paraded around town on a stretcher with their face showing. Everybody comes and everybody sees them. You know, they go to church and then they go to put them in a grave, as it were. But it's, you know, their point is that it's very important that everybody knows that person has died and therefore, you know, is accepted. Quite shocking, obviously, for some people. But I think it's, as you say, it's, this isn't an anthropology show, but I think what you said about the two points being valid, get on with it, but also, yeah, deal with it. It's interesting.
Of course, the thing that I guess formed me most of all was my schooling. Because I went to school, boarding school, of course, because we lived so far away from school that I could never have been a day boy. And I wouldn't see my parents. And after my father died, I didn't see my mother from the beginning of term to the end of term. So that was 3 months. And we were literally at school. School was really largely run on English public school lines. There was a lot of sport, a heck of a lot of sport. I wasn't bad at sport. I wasn't brilliant, but I wasn't bad. Mm. And so I really involved myself in just being with chums that played rugby and hockey and so on reasonably well.
Yeah. It's quite an extraordinary story, and I know your story, so I'm going to tell it. But a man who was brought up by two missionaries in a remote part of Africa, you know, at odds with school in the end, ends up coming to England, ends up becoming the managing director of Island Records. I mean, it's quite something.
Yes. I think if I got one thing from my parents, it was missionary zeal. So while I didn't really go along with their religion, and I'm not particularly religious, I guess I'm probably too scared to say there isn't one, but so I'm an agnostic. But they did imbue me with this missionary zeal. And when I was fortunate to join Island Records, and I did start just as a postboy, as a storeman, picking and packing records, and it was just a job to pay the rent, etc., I suddenly found myself getting interested in what they were doing. And I found myself liking the music, which was all ska. And I found myself drawn to it. And it was really rather odd, having come from Africa, to be suddenly in this Jamaican black milieu, if you like, and finding myself at home in it. And it was funny going to places like Brixton and traveling through those places where there were Caribbean communities to see the houses painted in wonderful colors and so on. And of course, Brixton Market selling all sorts of tropical fruit and vegetable. I felt very much at home.
I bet. And presumably somebody without any prejudice, or the sort of, I'm far better than you, attitude a lot of British people had at that time.
I was fortunate that I did grow up in a very remote place, and my childhood friends were African. And of course, my parents didn't have a prejudiced bone in their body. They were just not bigots. It's not true, though, that contemporaries at school and those of us that finished up over here, that some of them weren't incredibly prejudiced.
But back to Ireland, you sort of zoomed up through the ranks. Most people who know anything about the music business know that to run Ireland Records is, a dream come true. Ireland was always the sort of benchmark of quality, of grooviness, of hipness. And it must have been a fantastic thing to become the MD.
I was incredibly fortunate to have been allowed to have served an apprenticeship. Because yeah. I did just about everything other than work in the studio itself or be a musician. I did just about everything else. I was a production manager. I organized printing of sleeves and pressing of records. Mm. I organized selling of records, et cetera, et cetera. I did just about everything before I became managing director. So I really did learn what the music business was all about. And how to get records out there, how to promote them, how to market them. It was just so fortunate to have been allowed to have done that and to have been allowed to have done it by Chris Blackwell and David Betteridge, who was my predecessor as managing director.
So one of the people we want to talk about that was really a pretty important, very important person in your life was David Entobin.
Mm.
I think you first met David Entobin when you were the marketing manager and he was managing King Crimson. Is that correct?
King Crimson. Absolutely. He was managing King Crimson and Guy Stevens, who was our A&R man, and Chris Blackwell signed King Crimson. To a pretty remarkable deal, because it allowed David and his then partner, Johnny Gaydon, to take their copyrights back after a period. An unusual deal in those days. Of course, it was done so that we didn't have to pay them quite as big an advance as they might otherwise have commanded. But David and his partner, Johnny, were both old Harrovians. They were real Jack the Lads. They rode huge motorcycles up and down the King's Road. They had an office in the King's Road. Gracious me, they seemed to have it all.
Well, I think they did, didn't they? Because the next band they had was Roxy Music, and out of that, Brian Ferry, which was a pretty huge success.
The enormous success, and of course they followed that with Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and they also had T-Rex for a short time.
Oh, I'd forgotten that. Right, okay.
Yeah.
But you became pals, you became mates.
I did. I became a very good friend of David's. We hit it off, and I guess within Ireland, I was sort of their point person.
Yeah.
And I did all the marketing on their artists. I worked with David on producing the record sleeves. I worked with him on their artwork and so on, all his artists' artwork. So yes, we became very close. At that time, we were all just young. I mean, still in our 20s. We'd party hard. We'd lunch and drink way too much. And somehow or another, we managed, though, to get on with the work. And I guess we were zealous about that.
And then I think that EG, their company, parted company with Ireland and went to Polygram. And and I think they were paid a huge amount of money. That's sort of irrelevant, really. What's interesting to us is what happened to David, and without being salacious, because I think this is interesting, because this must have started to have some bearing on you. When did you notice that things were going slightly awry with him?
I think the reality is that because David left Ireland not long after I'd been made managing director, and we'd been furiously trying to re-sign him, but of course he was offered such a huge sum of money to go go to Polygram, although I saw him from time to time, I wasn't seeing him all the time as I was right. when we were working together.
Right.
So I didn't actually realize just how far he was going into a sort of a drugs world, if you like. I actually didn't know until he eventually had a big falling out with his partners at EG and left. He worked for a time at Henson's. I remember having lunch with him occasionally at Henson's, and he was we'd have an enjoyable lunch and drink a bit too much. I hadn't realized just how involved he was with other drugs.
And it was the drugs, as in cocaine, that was the culprit, the main
cocaine,
culprit.
Cocaine and heroin. Yeah.
Oh, really? And was he then by then married? Presumably was.
Oh yes, he'd got married back in the early 70s, so he already had two children. Yeah.
How did that pan out? How did that unravel the next few years?
It unraveled, as most of these things do, with him being thrown out of his home, of the marriage breaking down, of him finishing up in one little room in Earl's Court. And it was then, as he said to me, it was then that he said, I suddenly realized that if I continued, I would die, and I didn't want to. And he had been in rehab before, but this time he went to Broadway Lodge in Weston-super-Mare.
Yeah.
And it does have a record of success, I would say. And that's where he got clean. He always said... to anybody that cared to listen, he said, when I got that big deal and all that money, he said, I just stuffed it up my nose.
Right. And nobody really noticed.
Nobody noticed until really he couldn't cope and couldn't operate any longer.
Yeah, and he was quite a larger-than-life character.
Oh, he was absolutely a larger-than-life character. Remarkably talented, a huge fun to be with in every respect.
So was it quite a shock for you when you realised the extent of it, that, you know, there he was living in the one room and that it had reduced down?
Yes, it was. But, of course, the music industry, drugs and drug-taking was endemic. I'm sad to say that we didn't really realize that actually there was a lot more help on hand. I believe that there is a lot more help nowadays than there was then. It was kind of like, oh well, you know, he's an addict. It's sort of like, oh, he's an addict. My friendship with David meant that I didn't feel like that, but I think that in our sort of gung-ho youth, and certainly in my 20s, when people became addicted, it was sort of like, well, why are they doing that? It's their fault.
Yes, you know. Yes. You didn't connect any dots up to, you know, possible other further mental health issues. I mean.
To my shame, no, I didn't. I just thought, well, you know, they should stop.
But I mean, I think that's, you know, a lot of that's fair enough, because you just think, well, someone's really enjoying themselves. They're really, you know, crazy, but they're really just enjoying it. And then other people, you know, are using drink and drugs to cope. That's the, you know, that's the only way they do cope.
Mm.
But I again, not wishing to be salacious, I'm saying this out of interest. I think with David Enthoven, there was an issue to do with his father that was a blow for him. Is that correct?
Whether it was a blow, I'm not entirely sure.
Oh.
But it's true to say that the man that brought him up, it turned out, was not his real father. And I don't think he found out until relatively late. His father had been in Malta during the war, a very brave man, and his mother had had an affair. But his father brought David up, which is pretty remarkable, I think. But I don't know the real ins and outs of it. David didn't speak very much about it, other than to say, you know, the bare facts, as it were. But again, this was not something that was terribly unusual. People during war years had affairs, their menfolk off in far-flung places.
Yeah.
And sometimes, of course, you wouldn't have known whether they were coming back.
Yeah.
So I don't think this was a terribly unusual thing. But what was unusual, I guess, is that David's stepfather, I suppose you'd call him, actually did take care of him.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think people react differently in these circumstances. You know, some people just, well, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
Other people, oh my God, you know, I've always thought that person was my father, whatever, you know. But it was soon after this point that there's quite a nice sort of fairy story almost of the two of you getting together.
Yes. As I said, I'd never lost touch with David. I went to see him at Broadway Lodge, and we kept in touch. I was doing a book for Island Records, a poster book, and I went to see David in his office, and he had got back to managing Brian Ferry. And I went to see him in his office to try and beg some artwork from Roxy Music for this poster book. And when I walked in, David was in a high old state, because he'd fallen out with somebody that he'd shared the office with.
Yeah.
And he knew that he couldn't afford it on his own. And as it happens, my own lease for an office in Shepherd's Bush was coming to an end. And I said to him, well, if the rent's not too much, I could come and join you. And indeed, I moved in. I did say to him at the time, David, if you think I'm getting into management, forget it. It ain't going to happen.
Great. I hope that's framed up on the wall.
Should be, shouldn't it?
Just to keep the old mental health theme running, he had been to Broadway Lodge, which is a very, very famous 12-step addiction, alcoholism recovery place, and has a reputation for being the hardest place you can go, but it also has the highest success rate. And I think that he then basically embraced AA and the 12 steps program in a big way, as far as I can.
He continued with therapy as well, but I think the most outstanding thing was how he threw himself into helping others. It was just remarkable. I think I learned so many lessons from him in that respect. He really, really did go out of his way to help people that had mental health problems and that had addiction problems. He went out of his way to help them. He visited prisons. He spoke at AA meetings and NA meetings, and so on and so forth. He really did go out of his way.
Yeah. What was your take on all of this? I mean, were you sort of thinking, oh my goodness me, this is all a bit weird or dodgy? Or did you understand it straight away and get to like it? How did it affect you? I mean, I'm interested.
I guess I was one of those sort of get on with life type chaps, you know. I was therapy. What's that? What do you need therapy for? So I was very much of that sort of mind. I will say that I had my own issue, if you like, a complete loss of confidence when I left Island Records, and suffered from that loss of confidence for probably 2 years.
Right.
I didn't seek help, and I probably should have done. I didn't go to therapists. I probably should have done. I did have a wife and two children, though, that probably helped me to get through it. But I was in a pretty bad place. I think there was just a sort of a light bulb moment when I said, "This is ridiculous. Snap out of it. You've got plenty of things going on. Make the most of them." I think it really was just that, a sort of a light bulb moment, a sort of stop feeling sorry for yourself kind of moment.
Yes, yes. And often actually it can be by, you know, just taking a set of actions, you know, by, you know, I don't know, you know, sometimes it's helping the neighbor or something, mow the lawn, paint the house. Hang on, what am I talking about? I can, I'm not that bad, you know, I can pick up speed quite easily on this, you know, I'll paint the other one's house.
Yes.
But, I mean, I think
having two children and knowing that I had to provide for them also did help.
That's a great thing. That's a great thing. I like that. So, okay, let's just try. I'm going to try a little experiment. So I know with David Enthoven that he really did become a sort of, and I mean this in a very respectful way, he became an enormous Svengali to a lot of people.
Yes.
And you and him founded IE Music. I think your first signing was Massive Attack by their manager, I think.
Yep.
And second signing was Robbie Williams.
Yep.
Last year, Robbie Williams is quoted as saying about David Enthoven, "He guided me, loved me, gave the best advice, saved my life." And he said of you, "Tim is an absolute fucking bulldog, and I'm so happy that he's on my side. It's like having Mike Tyson in my corner."
Gracious.
So it's quite, that's 2019. What happened when you both signed Robbie? I mean, it was obviously quite a journey to go on. And I'm, you know, we want to hear about the mental health aspect. But what happened? What was the story?
Well, we met him. We were introduced to him via Brian Ferry's accountant. We met him. He came to the office. He'd had a couple of unfortunate management experiences and was looking for a new manager. Now, he had been partying. He had really been partying. And he was a touch overweight. But, boy, he walked into the office, and did he have presence. He just had presence. There's few people that really have it like that. And he came, and at the time we had an old dentist chair. It was a bit like a throne. and he just made a beeline for it and sat in it. We knew then that he was going to command things. And we chatted. Well, David and I really had no idea whether we could help him or not. We'd been used to dealing with people that actually had a very firm view of what they wanted artistically, whether it was Brian Ferry or Bob Marley and the Wailers or whomever. You know, these were people that really already knew the direction they were taking. And Rob had just come out of a boy band, and we'd never been involved with a boy or a girl band. We said, "Listen, you must go and talk to other people. Don't take us on without doing that." But he called us a week later and said, "Well, let's get back together again." And we did. And this time we went to his flat in Maida Vale. And he had been partying again. And The place reeked of alcohol and cigarettes, you know, that awful smell that one remembers from flats from one's youth. We sat down and we were chatting, and we kind of run out of things to say. It was getting a little uncomfortable, you know, what do we say next? When Robbie suddenly said, would you like to hear some of my poetry? And he recited two poems. And we just turned to him then and said, well, if you can do that, you can write lyrics. And we just need to find somebody that can help you put the music to it. So that was the start of it. That was when we agreed that we would manage him. And what a great day that was.
Excellent. But presumably there were certain blips along the way that needed ironing out, I'm assuming.
Well, there were blips because as has been very, very well reported and told by Robbie himself, he did have a problem with drink and cocaine. He did party rather too hard. It did get in the way of his work. I think he was very lucky to have David in his life, because David recognized what was happening, recognized probably why, and did an enormous amount to help Robbie understand the nature of drug taking and its underlying causes. And of course, it is all to do with mental health. It is all to do with wanting to block stuff out, ultimately. So David played a huge role in helping Robbie to come to terms with the things that were troubling him and that led him into addiction. But of course, along with so many other artists, it is an extraordinary job. It's really rather a surreal job to be able to get up on stage and entertain thousands of people. It would scare the life out of me. But to be able to do it, and to be able to do it with such pizzazz and style and energy, has to take so much out of a person. And it's not surprising that lots and lots of artists have fallen into addiction. It really isn't surprising.
Sure, it's a fuel. It can be a fuel. And also the other aspect of being in this sort of position is that there's a lot of temptation around you.
Oh, yes.
Particularly, you know, on the road. And there is a, you know, pernicious thing that I remember in the music business where, you know, people quite like the idea of getting somebody some drugs who shouldn't be having them, you know, to get them on side, you know, and all this sort of stuff. So I think it does take an awful lot of strength, you know, to withstand that, you know, because I think the whole thing with mental health, it is a very thin line. If you look at, say, Robin Williams, the comedian, and say George Michael, I mean, hugely talented people, massively talented, you know, tragic ends. Both who had, I mean, George Michael definitely had, you know, massive addiction problems, and Robin Williams was bipolar and all sorts of things. I'm just, I suppose, putting it to you that, you know, as you say, you know, Robbie Williams is very lucky to have David Enthoven there, and you, very lucky, both of you. And, you know, you look at other people who aren't so, you know, whether they choose, I don't want to have anyone around me, I don't want to go that, I'm self-sufficient. I mean, I don't know what you think. I mean, the great thing about you, Tim, is that you are somebody with enormous experience, going back to your days of dealing with Nick Drake, with Paul Kossoff of Free, Chris Wood, Traffic. You know, we talked about this. You've seen it.
Yes.
And whether now, and I'm not expecting you to say, well, you know, it's some grand thing, but what you think now, I don't know. You know, is it just the luck of the draw?
I do think you sort of do have to be lucky. There are opportunities that come along, but it's the grasping those opportunities that actually is the difference between people who are successful and people who maybe are not. I think that I did have a lot of luck. I'm not religious. I'm also not a fatalist. But sometimes you think, my word, if I hadn't bumped into so-and-so or if I hadn't met so-and-so. I mean, that moment when I walked into David's office, that was a moment that was just out of time. It was the precise moment when he had lost somebody that was sharing his rent, and in I walked like a lamb to the slaughter. But how do these things happen? I've no idea. But when he said, this is it, without hesitation, I said, I can come and join you. And maybe other people might have hesitated in that same sort of position. So I do think that, as I said earlier, my parents did sort of imbue me with a certain kind of a zeal for getting on with things, getting yes. on with life. And I think I still possess it. I think that my partnership with David became just a magnified thing. He had this zest for everything that he did. And so we were able to build this company, and it's, you know, it's not a huge company, and there are bigger companies and wealthier companies and all the rest of it. But we were able to build a company that had a certain reputation, reputation that I'm very proud of for honest dealing and for helping people, for helping our artists, but also helping our staff. And so we always made sure that our staff, if they required help, that we introduced them to people that could help. And David was really central to that. And his influence on me, this rough bloke from Africa, his influence on me actually did change my perception of these problems. We talked about Paul Kossoff and Chris Wood. Yes, I saw them going through their thing and ultimately leading to their deaths. I saw them when they were close to really finishing themselves off through drink and drugs. I didn't feel that I was in a position to help, but you know, actually looking back on it, I probably could have if I'd met David a little earlier into his whole recovery process.
Yeah, but also it was a different time, and it's just extraordinary to me. You know, I meet so many people, you know, in this world of mental health and young people, and the weird thing is what a poster boy Nick Drake is.
Mm.
These people, you know, not all of them, but you know what I mean? The ones who are slightly, who we would known being rather keen on Leonard Cohen. And I think it's tragic in a way. But question for you, how do you advise your staff in terms of mental health? Do you, for example, subscribe to the view, to the Tim Clark view, I think, which is make sure you have a life outside of work? Do you subscribe to that? I'm making it up for you. But
absolutely. Absolutely. I think I've always been fortunate in that respect. I've always had friends outside work. Indeed, my closest friends are all outside of this industry. And, you know, the simple things that I did, playing squash, exercising, et cetera, all of those things, I did with people who were not in the industry.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, really important. The thing that I'm not as qualified to do as David would be to offer them advice in dealing with specific problems, if they had mental health problems, etc. But we do know, and we do have, an excellent group of therapists that we can refer people to should they need it. And we do it, and we almost always pay for it.
But I suspect also that you are also somebody who believes in the concept of prevention being better than cure, and that it's quite good news to keep yourself, you know, in shape. And on that note, you know, we will conclude this with trying to find out what keeps you afloat. I think so many people get this wrong, that they are so fixated on work, social media. Oh my goodness, you know, what is happening? Money, finance, and they miss an awful lot of stuff. And to me, there's a set of life jackets that one can have that keep one together. And I know some people really like certain TV shows, some people really like certain films, books. And I know you talked about, you know, the Thomas Hardy novel, The Mayor of Casterbridge, being a favorite TV series. Why was that?
The characterizations, the characters were just so believable. The acting was out of this world. I it was black and white, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
It was that long ago, it was black and white.
Yeah.
And I can still remember following the poor old mayor and his and the ups and downs of his life. And who was it? Alan
Bates.
Yes. What an extraordinary actor. And I can just remember following him and all the other people that he interacted with and so on. It had everything. It had absolutely everything. Was the most moving, most moving TV experience to my mind.
I thought it was ironic that, you know, it kicks off with the hero of the book, whose name escapes me, trying to sell off his wife and daughter, auctions them off,
yes,
and then wakes up, having been dead drunk, wakes up the next day and goes, oh my God, what have I done? And then swears off alcohol for 21 years.
Yes, yes. I think that might have been part of it too, because I was certainly surrounded by lots of alcohol, and I guess at that time there were quite a few alcoholics.
Yes, yes. So with music, I know that you're a fan of, you know, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, and various others. But is there anything that you would really go, oh my God, that's for me? What would, or is it just one of those artists that, you know, you listen to them and?
Well, there are, but I guess as a whole, as a piece of work that I can listen to time and again, Mozart's Requiem.
Oh, great. Mozart's Mass in the C minor is the one for me, yeah. But it's very similar.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. No. Okay. We're on the same. Right, tick. I know there is a dog, a red Labrador, in your life now.
Yes.
That, I mean, you, have you always had dogs?
We've had dogs for a pretty long time, and we've tended to have Labradors.
Right.
More often than not, Labradors, yeah.
And what's the story with walking? Do you delegate that responsibility?
No, I do a great deal of the walking. I walk since lockdown. We got Buddy, dear Buddy, as a puppy just 4 days before lockdown. And it wasn't planned because of lockdown. We'd always planned to get this dog. It just so happened that we were able to pick him up just before lockdown. So we've had him since then. During this whole period, I guess I've been averaging 6 to 7 miles a day.
Pretty good.
Plenty of walking.
Okay.
Plenty of walking.
That's very, very good. Okay, I like that a lot. And you're still a big reader.
Yes, I think reading probably is my hobby. I was remember that my mother really taught me to read. I was in the bush. I was reading George Eliot and Jane Austen on the one hand, which gave me a real love of England without even knowing what England was, but I had this feeling for it. But I also read G.A. Henty. I read reams of G.A. Henty, which were real adventure stories and very much British Empire type adventure stories, you know, Wolfe at Quebec and things like that. I've gone through phases. I've read lots and lots of the Russian authors.
Solzhenitsyn.
I love Solzhenitsyn. He really is a favorite. I went through a period of reading all the great French, of reading American. I've read a lot. Sadly, I wish I could remember more of what I've read.
No, it doesn't. But I mean, what you convey is that you love it. I don't know if you're like me. I mean, what I find is that when I get into a really great novel, it is wonderful to just, oh, I'm fed up with everything. I'm going back in. Yes. And, you know, and I'm in the novel and go, everybody. And I'm in this believable land of whatever it is. And
yes,
I think it's a great stress buster reading.
Yes. It absolutely is. It absolutely is. I think very quickly. My aim, of course, was to be a writer, to be a novelist. And I was going to be the next Graham Greene or Evelyn Waugh, both favorite writers of mine. And I even had my own pen name, Howard Wallace or Wallace Howard. I wasn't sure which way around it would be. My brother's middle name Wallace and my middle name Howard. But it was living in Earl's Court and I was barely 20 and writing in this garret. I suddenly realized, gosh, this is quite a lonely life. And then I suddenly realized that actually I was never going to be a great writer because I was missing one key ingredient, Catholic angst. Catholic angst. I could never write like Graham Greene or Evelyn Waugh because that's what they had and I didn't.
You know, what can I say, Tim? In many ways, thank God you didn't have that Catholic angst because we would all be the much less for it. And we are the greater for knowing you. And I'm sure your wife and kids will be going, yeah, we wish you had that Catholic angst. But I bet they won't.
They might well say, yes, he does have that damn Catholic angst. We see it every day.
Yes, he's fibbing. Anyway. Should we be looking out for any particular albums, artists? Is there any sort of secret you could tell us that we don't know about coming up?
Well, we're thrilled that Robbie has written a new single for Christmas. It's called Can't Stop Christmas. And it is a subtle and gentle dig at the powers that be and the way they've handled it so far. There's even a reference to 1984 in the final chorus, which I think is pretty apt. And it is. It's as you'd expect. It's a jolly, funny, but underneath it all, quite serious song.
Okay.
We have a new Passenger album coming out in the new year, which we're very pleased about. And he's released a video and a new single a week or so ago. And that's going great guns.
Well, I'm going to end on this. There was a Scottish doctor, I'm going to call him Dr. McTavish because I've forgotten his name. But in 1876, he was asked, what do you need to be happy? And he said, you need three things. You need one, something to do. Two, someone to love. And three, something to hope for. Would you agree with that?
I'd go along with that. Absolutely.
Tip top and totally tidy. thank you for coming to The Shed and to Shed Talks. Absolutely brilliant. You're a top rocker. That's all I can say. A top rocker.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun, and actually really rather humbled by being invited into your lovely shed.
All right.
Thanks, Jeremy. Bye for now.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye. Thanks for staying with us. That, of course, is the signature theme for Karen Cowan, our favourite and treasured psychologist. And we're going straight over live to Karen now. So, overall, what was your impression of Tim Clark?
Well, I was really impressed. I felt he was a really great guy. He felt really grounded as he talked. And I wondered if that was based in his childhood with what he calls his zealous missionary parents in the African bush. And I wondered if that was really quite a solid grounding for him. And perhaps he also built resilience through, strangely enough, the death of his father, because quite often children who experience, and there's a lot of research around this, who experience difficult events, particularly bereavement at a young age, and who come out of it and things around them remain fairly much the same or get back to the same, often survive difficult things much better later on. So, for example, when he lost his job at Ireland, Tim felt very, very low, but he managed to get himself out of it. And I wonder if part of that was because of this background of resilience. And I also felt that he showed a lot of humility and a lot of regard for other people, a very high regard for other people and empathy towards other people.
Yeah.
I also noticed that he had a lot of interests outside the music business. And I think those probably helped him a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. But addiction, it is something that can affect anybody, isn't it? And it's something that, you know, it's not just all the sort of cartoon addictions, you know. You can be addicted to anything.
You can literally be addicted to anything, pornography, food, drugs, alcohol, gambling. And it can be rooted in trying to fill the void related to difficult events in your life, but it can also be pure serendipity that you get involved with addicted to drugs and alcohol and other things. For example, in the music business in those days, it would be quite difficult to avoid situations where there were drink and drugs. But I think the definition of an addiction is when it becomes a compulsion that's very difficult to stop despite its negative effect on your own life and the lives of others. And I think that's what happened to David, that his addiction spiraled out of control and had a major, major effect, sadly for him, on both his own life and the life of his wife.
Maybe we can just touch on that for 2 seconds, that a lot of people within all forms of poor mental health, not just addiction, but they don't often get it that their behavior and their addictions or their, you know, preoccupations have real consequences on other people, on those around them.
I know, it's a very strange thing. I've got several children, and one of the things I always say to them is, remember, every move you make in life affects someone else. And I think and that becomes particularly difficult for addicts to see. They often say, oh, so what? I can have a drink if I want, not affecting anyone. But it is.
Yes, absolutely. So, sort of lastly, I think this is quite important that, you know, I think Tim talked about his own company and how they really now provide help for, you know, anyone, counselling, health therapy work, for anyone in their company needs it. What about if you're not in that particularly brilliant company, what options are open to you?
Well, there's a lot of options out there. It can feel as if there aren't a lot of options because, for example, in the NHS, there's a lot of help available. But in terms of psychological help, there's often long waiting lists. But we should really advise people that if they're feeling really bad, they should, in the first instance, contact their GP. But aside from that, there's a lot of help out there. The Mind website would be one of the first places to look. It has lots and lots of information about where to go, about different apps. The Samaritans is a good place if you're feeling rock bottom. And there's a number of apps, the Headspace app about mindfulness. And of course, Narcotics Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous are wonderful places where you can make connections with others who understand what you're going through and start to conquer your addictions. There's a lot out there. Have a look at the Mind website and have a look at our website when it eventually comes up, Shed Talks.
Yes.
We'll have a lot of information on there. There's Fern Cotton's The Happy Place. There's a lot out there. Yeah. Start somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. And AA and NA would be, and GA, Gamblers and Others, would be very good places to start and, you know, get cracking.
Very good places to start. Yeah. And I always remember you saying, Jeremy, that a friend of ours became incredibly ill. And because he travelled a lot in his life, he didn't have very many people around him. And I remember Jeremy saying that would never have happened if he was in AA, because people are so, so supportive of each other. And
true.
Taking that first step to get there. Yeah.
That's absolutely true. Well, that's brilliant. I mean, it's so good that you're on board. And, you know, we're going to do quite a few of these, I hope, which are going to be very different, very varied, and, all to play for. Look at jeremythomastalks.co.uk website, and there's a Shed Talks part on that. It's got certain information. And Karen's just alluded to some other ones like Mind. But the trick with this whole thing is just to have some verite, have some honesty and a few laughs, and to give an insight into mental health conditions and just coping with life. And that's what it's about.
Blow away some of the unnecessary shame that's associated with addiction and mental illness.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. I think that's huge. Absolutely huge. Okay, well, that's absolutely brilliant. Karen, fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm going to say thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, everybody, for taking part. Thank you, Bryony B, for your help. Alex, our wonderful editor. Audio Boom for being our platform, Andrea Aquas for being our other thing, and all the other people who love Shed Talks. Until the next time, do do do.
Bye bye.